What tips or strategies do you recommend for investors who are managing this fluctuation in the market?
The easy answer to that is don't do fix and flip.
What would you say are some of the most important steps that a borrower should take to ensure that the relationships with their private money lenders stay strong?
Have your financials in order, tax returns. You're going to need that for a small bank, and private money lenders are very similar.
How do you determine that your fix and flip has the potential to actually make you money?
An easy rule of thumb a lot of people use is...
Welcome to Nursing Real Wealth. This week, we are thrilled to have Casey Gregerson on the show. Originally from Wyoming, Casey began his career as an engineer before transitioning into real estate. Today, he's the founder of a successful real estate investment company, specializing in both buy and hold strategies and fix and flip projects. Casey's approach includes the efficiency of vertical integration, as he also manages his properties through his own property management company. His journey and expertise bring a wealth of experience and insight to our discussion today. Casey, welcome.
Absolutely. Excited to be on here, Justin. Appreciate the invite. And yeah, man, anytime we could talk real estate or whatever, wherever we go today, I'm excited.
Absolutely. Sounds good. Why don't you kick us off a little bit with just telling us a little bit about your transition, what got you into real estate. Just give us a little bit of background on who you are.
You bet. And I can go really deep, but I'll give you the cliff notes and let you drill me down deeper. But ultimately, it started when I was going to school. So I grew up in Wyoming. I actually played undergrad or in football. I played football up in Montana, and then actually did that for 5 years, right? Did my undergrad there. Then I went to the University of Wyoming for a 2-year master's in petroleum engineering. And that's when I bought my first property, actually. It was my roommate who was selling the house at the time. His dad owned it, actually. And he's like, hey, why don't you buy the house? Why doesn't your dad or whatever? And I'm like, okay. And talked to my dad. My dad was able to co-sign with me. And he actually used some of my college savings, because I hadn't used all my college savings because I had some football scholarships. And I was able to use that savings to go use. It was really my first down payment to buy that first house. So that was 2010. And then I went and worked. So from there, I went to work for Shell. So I was a petroleum engineer, worked for Shell in Houston. And I really didn't do a whole lot for about the first 5 years. I kept that rental. I kept renting it out. Initially, my brother moved in and helped out. And then eventually my brother moved out, and I started managing it from afar. But I just had one, right? But then I read, just like a lot of other people, read Rich Dad Poor Dad in 2015. And I had this awesome role within my job where I would spend 2 weeks out in the field, and I would be, I'd be all in, and right, I'd be working for 12 hours a day and then have 12 hours off, right, for 2 weeks. But then after that, I'd go home for 2 weeks and have no obligations to work. So that's when I was reading these books. I was listening to podcasts while I was at work in the field or when I had downtime. And then those 2 weeks off, that's when I started finding deals and flipping houses and finding more rental properties, doing the burst strategy. And yeah, I mean, to kind of fast forward, I really built that up over the last about 8 years, really actively. And then I was lucky enough, about almost a year and a half ago, I finally got to the point where, and I wrote it out for a long time. I had my W-2 job. I really liked it because it was helping me build my portfolio, because small banks, which I could go into really deep there, but just having those relationships, I love the fact that I still had a great W-2 income, but I also knew how to fix and flip and manage contractors and manage properties. And I could kind of have it right. So I had the track record and I had the W-2 income. So I kept that for a long time to keep growing, but eventually grew big enough to where I couldn't keep up the W-2 job and with our small family and our 4 little boys running around the house.
Yeah, absolutely. So at some point you went and flipped into doing some fix and flips as well. And you still do that today. You do buy and hold. But why don't we get into a little bit about your fix and flip? Can you give us an overview of your approach to fix and flips projects?
Yeah, you bet. So, I mean, I've always looked for value add, right? I think a lot of people, when they're buying property, they want to find something. Hey, how can I, I think initially it was like, how can I get into this deal with low money down? And I wanted one of the best ways to do that is the burr strategy, which you could go in and you might have to put money down up front for a down payment, and then you finance part of it. But then if you buy it and you fix it up and you create equity, when you're done with the project and you've got the property up to the ARV or the top line value, then you go to the bank and refinance it. You get all your money back. So initially, that's what kind of got me doing the flips, right? And managing contractors and finding ways to add value. And then kind of just naturally, you're like, when you start buying all these rentals, you got to put down 25% every time, or try to get really creative. But you got to have some active income or some, you needed these big pops of cash, right? So that's why we're like, okay, well, some of these deals we're finding, instead of keeping as rental, why don't we try to flip them? And if we flipped them, we might go make $20,000, $30,000, $50,000. And that could be the down payment on our next rental property. So that was kind of like the first step of like why we wanted to fix and flip. And it's kind of evolved today to where it's just another part of our business to where it's a really good way to generate more active income. It's not quite as predictable as wholesaling, which you do as well, which that can be a little bit more like month to month income versus the flips are happening in big pops every 3-6 months, right? But we've now got enough to where we're doing, I mean, we've probably got around 5 to 10 of them going at a time. So at least ideally they're not all hitting at once. They're hitting at different stages, but it's great. I mean, it's the only thing that you don't love. It's kind of sporadic income. And the worst thing is when you're flipping a house and you're about to, for example, you got a bunch of cash in it and you're also about to realize your profit. And I've had it to where it's like, it's $150,000 swing that's about to hit your account. And then, but you're flipping it and you're depending on that end buyer who's getting financing. And I've had that happen before where like literally financing falls through. You expected $150,000 come into your business and it doesn't. And you still got the asset. It's still worth that, right? But you were planning on that liquidity. So that's been kind of, that's something we've evolved in the last couple of years to where like, you've just got to have a ton of liquidity when you're fixing and flipping.
Yeah. Yeah. Could you share a few successful fix and flip strategies that you've used in the past?
Yeah, you bet. I mean, really fundamentally, it comes down to the deal you're finding, right? It really starts when, and that's why we go direct to seller and we do a ton of marketing. Or alternatively, you don't have to do that, right? You could also work with wholesalers and other people to find deals, but you've got to go find a deal, right? I mean, again, I'm going to back up just a little bit to like, this was around 2019. So I would say from 2016 to 2019 in Wyoming, in our market, I was able to find fix and flips on the MLS. I was able to just go find a property that needed work on it. And I found it, fixed it up and created the value, right? And either kept it as a rental or I flipped it. But what we found is as the market heated up and prices started to go up, you could no longer find stuff on the market on the MLS that would pencil, right? So at that point, we had to start going direct to seller. And that's really been the big driver, is being able to go direct to seller. That allows us to find deep discounted deals and that we can go in and rehab. And yeah, and as far as like getting in and some, maybe some stories or best practices, if you go in and you buy the right price, then the next piece is managing the contractors, right? I could tell you guys the most, I don't know, I really truly think one of the riskiest parts of real estate is fixing and flipping. But it's because of the contracting piece. It's because of managing. Can you stay on budget? Can you stay on timeline? Like those are variables that you can't, I mean, you could typically understand, hey, what's the house going to be worth? You could figure out like what, I mean, obviously you know where you're buying it at, you know what you could sell it for, but that big piece in between with the rehab, that's the big variable. So we just had to get really good at estimating that. And I could tell you, it's a lot of trial and error and just years of experience. It's definitely not something I recommend somebody go all in on their first deal and do a fix and flip by themselves, because it's a good way. I mean, I'll be honest, there's plenty of our first several deals where we either made, some of them we lost money, some of them we made no money, and we spent a crap ton of time going through and basically just worked for free for the last 3 months doing a project, right? So it's, but as you do it, as over time, we've definitely gotten better.
Yeah, yeah. So Casey, for new fix and flippers entering the real estate market, you mentioned a couple of things that I don't think they're going to have available to them, right? Large amounts of liquidity. This is something you found was really important to be able to have. this is probably not something that a brand new fix and flipper is going to have. You know, what advice would you give regarding the risks associated with fix and flip projects? What strategies would you suggest to hedge against those risks?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, other than liquidity, so the liquidity is always the great way to do it. But really, I think partnering, right? I think a lot of people think they got to go do a fix and flip by themselves, and you could do that. Well, okay, let me give you two things. So first thing is go find a partner and who's got more of the capital. You go find the deal, you manage the deal and manage the contractors and basically do all the hustle, right? You do that part, have somebody else back you on the financials, and then you go do it. I mean, you could do it 50-50, you could do it however you want. But that's one good way to where, because if you're trying to manage the money and manage all that, it's a lot, right? And I think it's really good. And just go find a partner who's got capital, because there's a lot of people out there now that would love to operate or love to partner with somebody who's going to go out because they don't have the time, they got the capital, right? So I think that's one way to mitigate it. Second way is do the work yourself. And this is how a lot of people get started fixing flipping, and they do a house hack to start off. They buy their own house, they fix it up. I mean, that's what we did. And that's actually, I haven't shared that yet. So really my first true fix and flip was the first house that I actually bought in to for my family, right? So we moved to Billings, Montana. This was like 2015, 2016. I bought a house in a really cool area of Billings, close to downtown, older house, old Craftsman. But we basically went and we ended up, I mean, we didn't gut it down to the studs, but we did all new flooring. I redid the basement. We put up all, like, we added bedrooms, we added bathrooms down there. We had to dig up the drain lines and cut in the concrete, do all that. We built the garage in the back. But this was, and this is probably one of the best things I want to share with people, is I had to do it all myself to start off. I was lucky. My father-in-law was really handy. He knew how to, and if he didn't know how to do it, he knew somebody. He had buddies that were, well, he's an electrician by background, but he had buddies in the HVAC business, in the plumbing business, and in carpenters. He knew everybody, right? So those guys helped us, but literally I was there working with them, and we literally built a garage. And then I always like telling this story. So this was literally the day that my second son was born. He's now 8. So we were literally down there. So in the basement, like, we framed it all up. We put up the drywall. That was stuff that I could do. And then we were floating it, right? So I'd go put mud on there, and then it would dry, and I'd sand it all down, and then I'd go refloat it. And it was just this, I spent like 3 weeks on this. And then actually literally the day that like my son was born, I'm down there doing drywall. My wife's like, "Hey, it's time to go to the hospital." And I'm like, "Are you sure?" Or, cause we were like 2 minutes from the hospital. It's like, "Do you want to go sit up there, or do you want to be in the comfort of the house?" I was like, "Let's just wait." And plus, she hates me still to this day, but we'd already had our first baby, and we'd gotten like 2 or 3 trips to the hospital. I'm like, "Let's just wait. Like, can we wait?" Anyway, finally her mom comes down. She's like, "Casey, stop doing the drywall. It's time to go to the hospital." So we went, had our baby. But anyway, the reason I share that story is I finally got that project done, and then it took me weeks to do all this drywall, right? And then we had a little mishap where, like, we had a nice glass shower door, and to mount it, we needed to actually go and reinforce it with studs behind the drywall. So we had to go cut open the drywall that I've been working so hard on. But we paid a guy like $300 to come in there. He cut it out, put the stud in there, put the drywall back in there, made the patch, floated it all. And he did it in like an afternoon. And I was like, "What? This took me like 3 weeks. And anyway, at that point, I'm like, well, first off, I was pissed at my father-in-law. I'm like, "Why didn't we just have other people do this?" But at the point, I had to like learn it, right? I had to understand it. But now the reason I share all those detailed stories is I had to learn the trades. Because now when I'm a project manager, I'm estimating a flip, or I'm in the middle of a project and a contractor comes back with a change order or whatever, like, at least I know enough of what things should cost, what's involved, because that can really help keep you out of trouble, is if you have that knowledge, right, and have that experience. And I really recommend, to summarize that second thing, is go do the work yourself. Do a house hack. Do it with your significant other. Do it with your dad, your brother, like, whoever. Do it by yourself if you're single, and just go in. Do the legwork, learn it. And because the last piece of this is, if you're doing the work and you have the time, you can keep your budget down. Because when we're working with contractors, they're not cheap. And if you don't know what you're doing, you can get taken, right? So ultimately, do the work yourself or go partner. The long way of answering that.
No, I think that's great. Too often I see a lot of folks trying to get into fix and flip operations. It's their first fix and flip. They've never run a project. They don't have the history. They don't have the background. And they want to go and take on a fix and flip as their very first real estate investment, you know. And they're also looking for private capital to go and pay for the whole thing. So I think that's good sound advice. It's definitely what we recommend from a private money standpoint. If you've never done this, you got to go and kind of get your feet and your hands dirty in the work with some skin in the game first, and then you can come to private capital and, you know, we'll take it from there and help you scale up. Or you need to go and find a seasoned operator who's willing to go and, you know, partner with you and help you walk you through that first one, especially if you have no construction experience at all.
Man, what I want to share with you, Justin, I just thought of, and this is by far the hardest, one of the most expensive lessons I learned, but it's one of the best, is when you're fixing flipping, two exit strategies. Like, always got to have at least two. And I'm speaking from experience, right? So we were flipping a bunch of houses in Dallas-Fort Worth, and we moved up to a price point where, and again, the thought was, let's go fix and flip so we can keep buying rentals. Well, we went and these houses had like a $600,000, $700,000 ARV. And there was no way that if I could just keep those and rent them, just because at some price point in a lot of markets, you can't, it won't cash flow, right? So my big lesson there was like, so we had issues with contractors, we had issues with seasonality, we were using hard money and even a little bit of private money. And this perfect storm came in and hit us. And we're like, all we could do was literally just drop price and just take it in the shorts and lose a bunch of money. Versus if I'd have been at like 200, 250, I would have just held those and I would have just wrote it out and I would have kept them as rentals. And looking at that 5 years ago, those rentals would be probably double, right? So the biggest thing I learned it then is if I'm fixing flipping, either I buy it at such a huge discount that it doesn't matter and I could just drop it and it's just such a screaming deal, or and that's why I love Wyoming, the place we invest so much, is because we can still find deals that we can fix and flip. But if it doesn't work out, we can still hold that thing as a rental and we can still service the debt, right? It'll still cash flow on a regular loan. And those are harder right now at 8% or 9% interest rates, but I always just try to make sure. Well, and that's a whole nother segue. That's why we're doing more sub-2 deals. But I always want to underwrite my deal to where I can fix and flip it first. That's my first strategy. First exit. If that doesn't work, I want to be able to hold it as a rental.
Yeah. Before we dive into that sub-2 that you just mentioned, I do want to ask this question. How do you determine that your fix and flip has the potential to actually make you money? And I know this may be rudimentary to anybody who's listening and does fix and flips, but to all those who are, you know, thinking about getting into this for the first time, you know, how do you determine the max you can go and buy that property for and still make sure that you're going to come out with a profit?
Yeah. I mean, an easy rule of thumb a lot of people use is 25 to 30% of the ARV. So the after repair value, they'll do 25 to 20% of that. And especially this is like a wholesale equation, right? If you're wholesaling, typically if you're selling to a flipper, they want to buy at 25 to 30% of the value. And then, so let's say the house is worth 100K. You want to buy it at basically 70 to 75,000, but that's not including repairs, right? So that's the first number. Then you subtract repairs off of that. So if your rehab budget is 25,000 and you want to be at 75%, that's 75K minus 25. Now you're 50,000. So that's where you got to buy it at. That's a good, easy kind of rule of thumb that we go by. At the end of the day, a lot of investors are different. Like, we typically don't want to take on a flip unless we're going to make 50,000 just because of the time and everything that goes into it. And we're probably a little bit spoiled because we go direct to seller and we can find better deals. But at the same time, I mean, if I'm looking at a deal that like is a great rental I've done thinner ones when there were other exit strategies or other upside, right? One I like to do is like, I like to take some bigger swings on stuff that might hit higher. And when I say that, like, maybe it's got foundation issues or maybe it's got electrical or it's got some unknowns to where no one else is taking this project because it's a big project. But if I look at it, if the profit maybe on like a big, okay, let's just say it like this way. If I'm looking at a smaller rehab that's mostly cosmetic, I could probably be okay just making 30 to 40,000, right? But if I'm going to go do foundation, electrical, big scope, three to six month project, we're going to want to be at more like $70,000, $80,000, $100,000 profits. But what I've kind of learned over time is we could take those big swings because we have contractors, right? So a lot of people would be scared on the foundation thing because they're like, well, I got a quote for 30,000, but what if I run into a bunch of, what if that turns into 50 or 70 and now you're upside down? But at least with us, it will. And if you're using contractors and third-party contractors and you're not doing the work yourself, like, yeah, that's how you can get in a bind. But what I like, because we have in-house construction now, is let's say that I have that situation where, man, I got into this, I fixed the foundation, and now I did that. Now all my plumbing's messed up and my electrical or what, have a bunch of other issues. I've got in-house crews to where now we could, at least we're not paying retail, right? We try to underwrite the deal like we're paying retail, but if I got to shrink down and I got to go basically, I got to go make up that money somehow because we have in-house contractors, that allows us to do it, right? And I think that allows me to go after these deals that are a little bit more high risk, but they're bigger reward.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I've had a few folks bring me deals and they're not using that basic strategy that you mentioned for the basic wholesale. I think it's called the maximum allowable offer. Is I think the title for it. But you know, I had a young guy come to me looking for private capital on his first fix and flip, and their purchase price was 67% of the ARV. That was the purchase price before we even got into repairs. And I really challenged him. I was like, I don't think you want to do this because you're looking to put, what was it? I think it was like $60,000 or $70,000 into it. And you're already at, you're already at 67% of the ARV. So you're not leaving much meat on the bone for a margin of error, for profits, and also paying out your private money lenders. You know, what are you going to pay them out with? Plus your private money lenders aren't secured against that at the end of the day. You know, if it ends up failing, they're probably not going to get their money back.
Yep.
So yeah, too tight. That's great. So obviously, some of my audience is in Gator and sub two already. But for those who aren't and who are listening, I'd love to get into sub two. So, what exactly is sub two strategy and how does it work in real estate investing for you?
Man, I love it. I could go for an hour, maybe even longer on this. So many ways to think about it. Yeah. I'll get to this later, but I want to talk about how we're using and fixing flipping, and it's been a complete game changer for us. But let's start off with the basics, right? So when we're finding sub two deals, ultimately, again, fundamentally, you got to go back to, you got to be talking with sellers directly, trying to do creative finance and sub two and stuff like that. When an agent's involved is an uphill battle. It can be done, and we've done it before, but it's not easy. So you got to be talking to sellers, and you got to be talking to a lot of sellers, because a lot of these people who try to go find a creative deal, it can be very defeating. Because I would say, probably 1 out of 10, maybe less, like of people that actually are willing to do this. And a lot of people you're going to pitch. The most probably defeating thing is you go pitch this deal and you get them on board and they feel like, oh man, I finally got somebody who's going to do creative finance. We get to the paperwork. You might be down to the last step and then they bail on you or whatever, like something happens and it's so defeating, and it happens all the time. So you ultimately got to be doing, you got to be repping it and getting it and working a ton of leads to make sub two work. But ultimately you're just pitching, and it's a really easy pitch for me, right? Because I've been doing it for a while, but I think it lands really well. And it also helps my cash offer land well. So what I say is, hey, we've got kind of two basic types of offers. I can offer you cash and I can get it to you quick, but I'm very transparent. I'm like, hey, I need to buy this at 76, maybe 60% on the dollar because of the way the market's going. And I got to hedge my risk, right? But alternatively, if you don't need all the money right away and you can sell on terms, well, there's this great option with creative finance. And that's when I kind of explain, hey, like I could actually get you market value for the house if you let me take over your loan. And essentially there's like three different buckets when it comes to this. The easiest one is free and clear. If they don't have a loan on the property, you're literally just negotiating how much money, you're literally just negotiating how much money they're getting up front. And then what do the payments look like and interest rate and stuff like that and purchase price. But all that stuff is negotiable. And ultimately, the beauty of it is you just get that's where it's really good about. You got to be able to ask questions and understand what's important to them. But if you know that, hey, they don't need as much money up front, and you got to know what's important to them. on the subject too. So you can really make the terms up as you want. So it could be a large down payment. It could be large purchase price, but you've got to ask the questions to understand what's important to them. Do they want to make more money in the long run, or do they need more money up front? And so you really get us to get to design this deal however you want. And I guess this, so that's really easy on the seller financing because there's no lender involved. The kind of the next stage is, well, what if they have a mortgage? Well, often what we'll do is we'll take over their mortgage subject to. So that means we buy the property, the deed will change over to our name. They'll actually sell us the property, but the mortgage, it stays in their name. And we're always very clear, hey, the mortgage stays in your name, but I will become responsible. I will take over those payments. And it's a pretty easy pitch now in today's market where there's 9%, 8% rates, right? I just tell them, hey, I just can't make this deal work at 8 or 9%. But if I could take over your 2.75% loan, that allows me to pay more. So that's kind of the second piece. And then the third evolution of it is what we call like a hybrid. So often you'll find people that maybe the house is worth $200,000 and they have a $100,000 loan. Well, they're going to want to get more than $100,000. So what we'll do is we'll slice it up into two pieces, right? The first piece is their loan that we take over subject to. And the second piece is their equity, and we'll set up a payment for that. And again, it's completely negotiable what that payment looks like as far as monthly interest or monthly payments, monthly interest, how much money they want up front. But ultimately, we put together these hybrids to where we'll make a payment, we'll make their loan payment, we'll make a payment to them based on their equity. And then we'll take over the property. And often we can do this with little to no money down. They're all different, right? There's also some sellers that like, they could, I will still take over a, going deep here, but especially when you're working with private money lenders, what I love doing is, let's say that this seller, he's got a ton of equity. Let's say he only owes like $100,000 and the house is worth $300,000. So there's a bunch of equity, but he needs like $50,000 up front. Typically, most wholesalers or investors would be like, that's $50,000 up front. I don't want to put that much down. Well, what we'll do is we'll work and we'll actually bring in a private money lender who will help fund that $50,000, get them out. But it went from the private money lender's perspective. Think about this. They owe $100,000. And now we've got that $50,000 with the private money lender. It's in second position, but you got to look at the overall deal, right? This house, so that 100 plus the 50, we're at 150 total, but we're saying the house is worth 300. So your LTV is literally, or basically your percentage of the actually of the value is only 50%. So that's a safe deal, right? So, and you get them, and the seller gets what they want. They get their 50,000. And then here's another trick is, that remain, you'll often put the seller in third position or basically let them get paid when the house sells. If it's a flip, they get paid when it sells. Or if it's a rental, I guess basically the same thing. It'd be like a 5-year balloon. After 5 years, we'll pay you. But ultimately, that's a way to get a private money lender in. They could feel secure. The seller gets paid. You assume that's like 3% loan. It's a really cool way to kind of structure these deals and make them cash flow. Because honestly, there's a lot of deals in today's market that they don't cash flow at 8%. But when you do it in this strategy, like think about that. Even if you're paying 12% to a private money lender, but you're paying 3% to the seller, if you blend that together, it still makes sense.
Yeah. Yep. So tell me how it merges. You mentioned how it's a game changer with fix and flip. Tell me how you use sub two with fix and flip. Obviously you're getting rid of hard money loans, which are a piece of work to sometimes deal with, expensive rates and expensive fees for anything that's running a little bit over time.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you an example deal I literally put together today with actually I met them through Sub 2 and Gator Lending, and we set this deal up and they really liked it. So ultimately, this is a fix and flip in Billings, Montana. So the seller owed. So this we get really creative here. So hopefully I don't make it too confusing, but I'll try to give it to you concisely. So picture the seller, because it's important to understand like why would they ever sell this? Because that's the question I kind of get. So the seller's here, they owe $180,000 on their house. The ARV on this house, once I fix it up, it's like $430,000. But it's like a $100,000 rehab. It's like a big significant rehab. So what I go to them and I say is hey, I could flip this, but we're going to have to work on this together pretty much really like as partners, like moving the same direction. So I say, hey, let me take over your mortgage subject to. So I take over the 180,000, I take over subject to. I then tell them, I'm going to flip this house. I'm very transparent. Like, we're going to flip this house. And when we flip it, that's when you get paid, or that's when you get paid, and that's when I get paid. So we break it down as I take it. So the one, when the house gets sold, the first 180, obviously the lender has the first position lender, Wells Fargo, whoever it is, they got to get paid first, right? Then I say the next chunk goes to my company, right? Like, I got to get paid back for doing this rehab, and I'll work in that number. So I'm obviously going to charge like retail, like a normal other contractor would, right? So we're very transparent that that number, for example, on this deal, let's say that number was 120,000. So, right. So we're at 180 plus 120. Now we're at 300,000. So I say I get it up to, when the house is sold, 180 goes to the lender, the next 120 goes to me, right? And then from there, I say, hey, after that point, we'll split it. We'll split profits, right? But what I love about that is I lock in, like, I make sure that I'm going to be right on this deal, because I'm getting paid after the bank gets paid, right? And I'm very transparent with the seller. I'm like, hey, if something happens, if the market changes, if like they keep raising interest rates and price, and there's no buyers and we have to discount this house to sell it, like, that's a reality that could happen. And I just let them know that there's no guarantees you make anything on the back end, but we have a clearly defined profit share on the back end of the sale that they get to participate in. But I like it. So here's where the kind of the private money lender piece comes in, and why I brought up the example is I then bring in a private money lender for that 120, to where I pay them 12%, for example, in this deal. They get 12% annualized, and they come in second position. But again, think about the numbers there. It's 300,000 total debt with the 180 plus the 120. So, and the house is worth 430. So that's like a 69 or 65% LTV. So the private money lender felt good and secured. There's still 30% of cushion in that. And that's with all the rehab, everything worked in. And yeah. And then I was able to go do the deal with the private money lender's funds. I can keep my capital in my, like, what's important for me now is keep my capital in my core business, right? Which is fixing and flipping, wholesaling, or finding deals off market, and also property management. So I want to keep my cash in here. I can now go use a private money lender's funds to go flip this, and there's still profit on the back end, right? So I'm still going to make, if it's 50-50 or 75-25 on that last bit of chunk, I still make it. But the point is, like, I wanted to, and the reason I started doing this was rates were going up, and I didn't know what was going to happen in the retail market and fixing and flipping. And again, going back to my like two exit strategies, I'm like, I don't want to be stuck with a house I can't sell, especially when I'm using private money. So I'm like, let's build in and make sure that we're protected to where when we sell this, we got to get the payback first. And again, it's all negotiated on the front end. But that way, if let's say that looks like the market's going to get better, fortunately, but I was going to be prepared that, hey, if I got to drop the price, I could still do it. I could still flip this house. I could still keep my contractors busy and keep my private money lender paid and still ultimately make a small profit on the deal.
Right now, not to get too sidetracked off of sub two, because I still want to continue talking about a few elements of that. But right now, what are you dropping your estimated, you know, obviously you're calculating ARV based off of now prices, mm-hmm. but you're figuring the potential that you're going to have to drop it by a certain amount in order to sell it pending changes in the market. What is your mm-hmm. typical drop from the today's ARV that you're kind of planning in the future that you might have to drop it to?
Yeah.
What is your kind of going number that you'd like to go with?
Fortunately in our market, we weren't like Boise or Las Vegas where they had like crazy 30% appreciation and then they dropped 20%. So we never really even dropped. We just kind of flatlined when interest rates rose. That was a scary thing where you're like, okay, am I going to underwrite my deals at 30% discount or 20%? Like that's all the margin, right? So ultimately we haven't really approached it that way. If I was going to just say a really easy rule of thumb, I would say another 10 to 20%. If I was buying at 70% on the dollar, I want to buy at 50 to 60% on the dollar. Would be one easy rule of thumb. But really, in that last example I showed you, that's exactly how we've mitigated the risk. We're like, let's go take on some sub two deals where we make sure that we get paid first. Because if you looked at that one where the house is, if I put in 180, either way, that deal was underwritten to where I was at like 50 for as far as like capital I had into it. before I brought a private money lender in, I was in like 50% cents, 50 cents on the dollar to where I could fire sell that thing and still move it. And that's exactly why I did it. Cause I was like, I don't know. I mean, the market, I don't know. Like, again, these are all like battle wounds I've had from the past where I was fixing and flipping. And I didn't, some of these houses wouldn't have been great rentals. I mean, could I have made them work as like a short term? Probably, but I didn't really have my kind of steady Eddie, let's keep it as a rental back second option. So I'm like, I got to be able to make sure I could discount significantly to do it. But the thing is, like, you can still get rewarded, right? Because there's a lot of people who are not touching flips. And I think it's been an incredible opportunity over the last 12 months and even honestly ongoing, because there's still a lot of people, because of what we're talking about, because of the volatility in the market, they're scared to flip. Well, that makes it even easier. I mean, honestly, it's why I've negotiated such good deals on the front end and such good financing, and that these sellers are willing to take sub two terms is because there's no other flippers on the market. It's not like it was 2 years ago when they could just put their house that needed a bunch of repairs and all this work and put it on the market and get multiple offers. That those days are over.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've already kind of talked about some of the main benefits of sub two. What, if any, risks are there associated? I'm sure there are. So what risks should investors be aware of when it comes to sub two? And could you share some best practices for those interested in this strategy?
Yeah, I think the first one I kind of talked about a little bit is it takes a lot of reps, and it takes a lot of talking to people to get it done. And I think if people think that they're just going to go just try it out and it's going to work out, it's a lot of people will just lose steam and they'll end up giving up. So I think first thing is you got to really commit to it, and you got to be planning. You've got to have some sort of strategy to talk to a lot of sellers. So that'd be the first one. The biggest one, and everybody talks about the most, and I think it's worth discussing, is the due on sale risk. So when you take over a mortgage subject to, there's the risk that technically the lender could call the note due. That's obviously the seller's question. Like, well, and it's funny because title companies, real estate agents, they talk to you like, well, wait, you can't do that. That's illegal. You're buying the house and not paying off the lender and not notifying the lender. And there's also a lot of title companies that won't do it, right? But there's also plenty that will. But ultimately, it's like, how do you mitigate their risk? So a couple ways you can mitigate it. One way is, the best way is just to have enough equity in the deal, right? If you have a deal where you're buying it at 70 cents on the dollar, and you buy it sub two, well, let's say that they do call the loan due on sale. You're like, all right, I got to go refinance it. Ideally, you go to a small bank, but worst case, you go to a private money lender or hard money and you get it done and you refinance it, right? One other thing that's important to know, though, is like, let's say that, okay, so how it usually goes down is the lender finds out about it. In the like 1% of times this happens, typically the lender finds out and they call you like, hey, because I've talked to a lot of different people I haven't experienced it yet. But I've talked to a handful of people who have, and they're like, lender calls you, says, hey, we see that the deed has changed. The deed is no longer in so-and-so's name. It's in your name. We still have the mortgage. And typically a lot of times you just go like, okay, yeah, I understand. You tell them what you're trying to do. Like, hey, this is a rental property. I plan to make the payments. Do you want to see my credit? Like, how do you want to do this? Typically they're just like, yeah, keep doing what you're doing. Like, we don't want to foreclose, right? But let's say that they do want to push it, in the rare opportunity where a lender's like, you know what, I'm going to be stubborn on this. I don't care. Like, well, for people, you got to understand that lenders don't want to foreclose. They're not in the business of owning homes, right? They want to lend money. And if you're paying your loan, they're not going to have an issue, right? But let's say there are some lenders out here. So first off, you've got to know the lender you're working with. In Wyoming, we have what's called WCDA loans. Those are meant for first-time home buyers, and they have some restrictions. They're very like, they will call the due on sale, and they don't care. Like, they're firm on it. So if that does happen, it's like a 90-day, like, depending on your state, right? The foreclosure does not happen overnight. It's not like they call you next day, you got to pay it off. I mean, they might tell you that, but their recourse is a foreclosure, and the foreclosure takes time. So that's going to buy you, again, might buy you 90 to 120 days in some states to either, again, sell it, refinance it, do something with it, to where you're going to have some runway to do it. And I guess the third mitigation that I would like to talk about is ultimately you can deed it. I've seen people do this. They will deed the property back into the original seller's name. So at that point, bank's happy. Deed is back in their name. Everything's back to the way it was. And then you set up, you could set up a contract for deed or land. It's called a land contract. It's called a bunch of different things depending on your state. Essentially, it's a contract saying it's a form of seller finance or even like a rent to own. But there's a lot of other agreements that you can set up that accomplishes the same thing to where you're making a down payment, you're making monthly payments, you have a 5-year loan. They have all the same terms, but they stay on the deed. There's 100 different ways to structure this, but that's one way that you could do it and the lender shouldn't have an issue. And then at that point, you've solved your issue. You've avoided the 1% chance of a due on sale and you're still fine.
Love it. Just got to be a little creative. So kind of moving into the next topic that we want to talk about, private money lending and the use of your fund. But before we get into talking about your fund, you've consistently utilized private capital to fund your fix and flips and your buy and hold acquisitions. Why do you believe learning to work with private money lenders is so critical for scaling operations in real estate investing?
Yeah. I mean, I'll back it up to any lender, right? I had to learn this several years ago when it was in 2015 when I did my first. So I had the first property. And what I did is I went and did a cash out refinance, pulled out $50,000, and I went and bought the second one. But I didn't go to a mortgage company. I went to a small bank, which that relationship is so similar to a private money lender. And that's what's cool about it. It's like you're not working with Wells Fargo and yeah, you know, guys, everybody who's done that knows how that goes. And not just Wells Fargo, Rocket Mortgage, you name it, right? You're working with a small bank or a credit union and you're getting to know that banker, right? So you want to get to know them and explain what you're trying to accomplish. And yeah, and I it's so paramount and I'm so glad that I did it then because there's so many people that like, they just think they want to get a 30-year fixed mortgage. And so they're going to go jump through all those hoops. Well, that's great if you want to buy maybe 3 or 4 properties, but if you want to grow and scale, they're not going to grow and scale with you. You're going to grow and scale with small banks, credit unions, private money lenders, those type of people. And those are based on relationships. And I just started investing on it early on. Again, the first example was working with a small bank. And I always like to share the story. It's probably one of my proudest things is we had it was going to be a fix and flip. That was a perfect burst strategy. I bought it for 180. I was going to put like 60 into it. So it's going to be all in at 240. House appraised for, I bought it for 100. I was going to be all in at 180 and it was worth 240. So it was a perfect burst strategy where I can get all my money out. Problem is when we went in there and closed on it, we gutted it down to the studs. Well, the framing was done so poorly. The city came in and condemned it. They're like, you got to tear that down. And I'm like, oh man, that's going to be way over my $60,000 rehab budget. So I had to go call my small bank and I was scared. I was really scared. And I was just like, hey, Kent, what's his name? I'm like, Kent, here's where we're at. Like, I'm going to finish this out, but like, what do we do? What's next? Like, I want to do new, we're going to have to rebuild this. Can we restructure the loan? And fortunately I had started to create a relationship with him and he believed in me. And so we restructured the loan. We did and he was really helpful for me to where he helped structure the deal because I definitely did not have, like $150,000 ready to go on of what I needed to do on this new construction deal now. But he kind of worked with me. We actually ended up selling part of a business to help fund it. But ultimately I got it done. It's a threeplex in with Laramie. It's one of my best assets. And we got to the end. And what I always like sharing is I got to the end and another thing I do with private money lenders with small banks is like anytime I'm in town or I'm around them, I either go to lunch with them or just go connect with them. And anyway, so I'm sitting in Kent's office and we're talking about it. We're talking about the war stories of putting this house together. The other thing is we poured 2 foundations on this house. I poured one and it failed. And we had to actually, that was a whole mess with that contractor. But anyway, we had to tear out that foundation and re-pour it. But eventually we went vertical. We got it built and it's a great asset. But anyway, we're sitting in the office and he's like, Casey, I really appreciate what you've done. He's like, like a lot of other lenders or a lot of other borrowers, they probably would have folded and not finished this project. But that means he's like, I want to thank you. And the bank thanks you. And he goes, this will make such a difference anytime in future loans. When I go to loan committee And I go and say, hey, this is, this, you guys remember Casey? He was the one that finished the job and finished this this complete nightmare. And he didn't give up on us. He finished the project. He paid us back. It's a great performing loan. He's like, that's ultimately going to help me. And it was a really cool moment for me to like, now, hey, now I've got a great relationship with a small bank that I can scale with. So the reason I bring that up is like doing that with your private money lenders, small banks, whatever it is, you've got to invest the time because they're the ones that can help you grow. They're the ones, they want to see you grow and they're the ones that can grow with you, right? But they really need to know you and they need to know that, he talks about the five C's. I always talk about it. It's cash flow, it's credit. And one of the other big ones without going to all five is character. The bank wants to know who you are and what you're all about. And in that moment, I was show him what I'm all about. And ultimately you want to do that with your private money lenders to know that at the end of the day, you're going to make them whole. Cause that's a huge, that's honestly as important as the deal in the underwriting.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, I mean, a small town bank probably wouldn't loan to you if you didn't make them whole on their loan. And same is going to happen with a private money lender. Not making your lender whole is a nail in the coffin with that relationship, mm-hmm. you know? But on that note, you did mention it is a relationship and you did mention some really good things, but you know, what would you say are some of the most important steps that a borrower should take to ensure that the relationships with their private money lenders stay strong and mutually beneficial over a long term?
Yeah, I think initially you just want to, well, one thing is just having your financials in order. Like step one is have your financials in order, have like your credit statement, have your personal financial statement, tax returns, whatever they want. You're going to need that for a small bank and private money lenders are very similar. So I just I keep that all in a file in a folder and I just keep it up to date. And because they're going to want it. And if you can, honestly, if you want to separate yourself from the other borrowers, is have that stuff ready. And when they say send it, you're ready to send it and have it organized. That's going to really get you off on the right foot. And then I think kind of building off that is just communicating, right? So now you've given them what they needed. You make like, once you get into a deal is keeping it up to date. And another thing a lot of people do is at the end of the project, like it's funny, you talk to a lot of small banks or even private money lenders. They're like, oh man, all I know is I got paid back. Like the title company called me for a payoff I gave them and that was it, right? But tell them, like show them the story at the end, show them how you were successful. And I think them seeing the full story is really cool, right? And honestly, I mean, because everybody can underwrite a deal and say they got a deal, but who can go full circle and show and execute and when they get it? But don't forget to tell them the story at the end, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's absolutely part of that relationship building for sure. You know, like you know, private money lenders aren't typically, at least the ones I've worked with, and myself included, I'm not in it to just lend money and see a check come back. I want to be a part of a project. I want to see that project come to fruition. I love seeing the fruits of this relationship and this investment. It's a neat yeah. thing to see for sure. Cool. One thing I think that's great advice.
Yeah. Last thing is just being upfront with like what are your end goals, right? And understanding, especially with a private money lender, like, or if it's a small bank, you want to know, hey, how can I grow with you? What is out there? Because ultimately you want to get to better terms, right? So that's why I think if you're upfront with your private money lender, say, this is what I can do now, but this is where I want to get to. And this is my vision. This is where I see, and this is how I see us growing together. Because as you come with more experience, you become less risky, right? And you can maybe earn better terms. So being upfront with your lender on that from the front end, say, hey, this is where I'm at now. This is where I want to go. And then typically that helps you know who to invest in, right? Because if you might not want to invest with a private money lender who doesn't value that, right? If they're like, hey, no, I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's some lenders that are making really high rates on high risk people. And if that's all they want to do, that might not be who I want to invest in. I want to invest in somebody who's like, hey, let's invest in each other to where we both make money and then terms can continue to get better.
Yeah. All of the private money lenders that I work with start high, but when somebody proves themselves, there's absolutely that place to go and renegotiate and to begin to see much more, you know, reasonable terms. Because a lot of private money lenders right now, especially on short-term or gap funds, I mean, they're hitting that 18-20% range pretty typically. But as you build, you know, your reputation as an investor with them, there's a lot of openness to go and drop those because you are the rates you pay are really associated with either the very observable risk of the investment mm-hmm. or the perceived risk because they don't know the borrower.
Yeah.
Cool. What advice would you give to somebody looking to secure funding for their real estate project through private money lending? First time doing it. What advice would you give them?
Yeah. The step one is the getting your documents and everything kind of outlined, and having it kind of presentable, ready to go. So that's step one. Sharing your track record, right? Kind of having an outline about who you are. And again, these are, again, the more organized you are and the more, if you're ready, it takes some time, right? But if you're planning to repeat and do this multiple times, just invest the time on the front end. We always just produce like a one pager about us, like about me and my track record. Another thing I do is we call it a project book, and I try to keep up with all of our fix and flips. And every time we just make a little one pager of like, what did we buy it for? What was a rehab? What did the private money lender make or whatever? Just some bullet points and some before and afters. People love that, right? So we just try to keep that going. And as you build more and more of a track record, all of a sudden you got like a 40 page project book. So it just really shows the track record versus me saying, hey, I've done all these flips. Be like, hey, I could tell you about a bunch of them, but here's a project book if you want to go look at it. So that's one. So that, and then I think showing them your market, right? And where you're at, like, it's, especially for me, we invest in Wyoming and Montana. It may be a market these people have never lent money in. But I like to show them like, why do I invest in Wyoming and what are kind of some of the high points? Cause I can pitch it all day, but ultimately I want to express that to them. If I'm on a call with them and have it kind of a first interaction with them, I want to tell them about Wyoming, but also want to be able to share them like a one pager to where they can have it writing. Maybe they're going to go share that with another lender or they're going to share it with their underwriter, but I want to give them something that shows like why we like our market and why are we investing there? Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. You mentioned using a fund that you've set up a fund. Love to get into that. I think funds are something I've heard a little bit more about recently. I'm actually very interested in just educating myself personally about it. But could you elaborate on how you utilize this fund that you've created, the benefits that it provides for your investment activities, and the benefits that it provides for those who invest with you?
Absolutely. We really designed this because to me, the easiest part of our company is being able to find an off-market deal, fix it up, and then hold it as a rental, right? We've talked about fixing and flipping and a lot of the risk today. It's still great, and we still do it, right? It's a still key component of our business. But to me, the less risk, our bread and butter is just do the full cycle. So, right. But buying it, fixing it up and holding it requires way more capital. And it requires working with people who want to look over a 5-year horizon, maybe a 10-year horizon, but they're not looking over the next 12 months. They're looking longer. And to me, I mean, just if you look at real estate over time, anybody, if you haven't, I challenge you, go look at home prices and compare it over time. It's incredible. So if we play the long game, it is so hard to lose, right? As long as you keep good liquidity and you play the rental long game, yeah, it's the test of time. It's undefeated. Somebody else, Jimmy Breland, has a good quote for it, but it's undefeated. Like, it keeps going up, right? Real estate keeps going up. So we really designed the fund to be able to take advantage of that, to where I could provide limited partners who wanted to basically get what I'm getting as far as getting these properties that we find, fix up, and keep as rentals, and buy them with me as limited partners. So it was because we were able to load up inventory of that product, right? We can go build a portfolio. For example, I built my portfolio. I mean, I took our portfolio from around 2 million to 15 million in like 18 months when I really had our marketing cranked up. And that was total value, right? Total asset value. But I'm like, hey, well, why don't we just go do that for a fund and raise way more money and really ultimately multiply what we're trying to do? And then I guess kind of the benefits to your other part of your question is, as opposed to a private money lender, that's a great, they could get great returns. I think there's a time and a place for that. But the difference here is now you're going to get appreciation and you're actually going to get more of the upside because you're a limited partner. Like just talking about the, appreciation and upside. But the other thing is depreciation and tax benefits. So if you're making money, what I love to tell people is I have a cool, unique situation where I make money on my flips and I show profits, but then I have rental properties that I depreciate. So this depreciation often can wipe out all the income. Even though I'm making money on my rentals, I'm showing losses. And again, this is all per the IRS. They're phantom losses because of depreciation. Those losses offset my active income from my fixing and flipping. So again, you need to talk to a CPA on this to make sure it applies to you. But within my fund, because we can fix and flip, and we can also buy rentals in it, we're able to write off a lot of that income to where a lot of the income generated by the fund is essentially, it's distributed tax-free. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the, say we sell everything in 5 years, at that point we would have to, well, at that point it's kind of cool. Now we get to figure out, okay, are we going to go do a 1031 exchange and buy the next one? That way we don't have to pay that taxes and just keep kicking it down the road and just keep working it, right? So again, depreciation, tax write-offs is a huge benefit. And then just the fact that you're an equity partner, as the asset grows, you're able to just realize that the upside versus if you're a private money lender, you're locked into that rate and you don't make any more. Typically, if I'm the flipper, I get the upside. But when you're a limited partner, that's when you get a share of the upside with me. So I'm the general partner in our structure. And then I bring in limited partners who bring in the capital and get to get all the benefits of being a real estate investor just like me.
Yeah, yeah. And you fund buy and hold and fix and flip through your fund, correct?
Correct.
So, yep. So you share the profits with everybody that's in the fund. What are the limitations of a fund? I know there's a few, but you know, what are some of the limitations of the fund?
Yeah. So first thing is you got to choose like what type of fund you're doing, 506C or 506B. So our fund is currently for accredited investors. So you can look into the accredited qualifications. You'd be surprised in today's world with how much inflation has gone up and what people are making. A lot of people would be probably surprised that they're actually accredited. So first off is our fund is just reserved for accredited investors. I do work with unaccredited investors that I have a relationship with. That's what I use a lot of my private money lenders for, which is a completely separate thing from the fund. But the nice thing is for accredited investors, we can actually go and market and we can go. Like I could have somebody who's never met me come and invest in that deal, right? Because they're accredited and it's gone through the filings with the SEC and all that. Yeah, so that's one of the limitations. And typically the amount of you want to invest, like in our fund, it's a minimum of $30,000. But actually the way I structured mine is like you actually get a higher preferred return. If you do, it's 7% for up to $30,000 and it's above $100,000, it's 8% and above $250,000. It's actually a 9% preferred return. So you actually have upside for investing more. But sometimes in a fund, you can be limited by, there are some funds out there that'll take less than, say, $10,000. But typically, it's a larger investment. Those are kind of the main limitations. It's really pretty open. And I guess the other one I would bring up is the timeline, right? If you're going to go into a fund, like we try to be accommodating to our investors if something did happen, but you need to plan on your money being at work for like ours is like a 5-year horizon is how we've underwrote it. We might sell it sooner than that and pay everybody back and have a great return sooner, but you got to plan. And we might go longer than five, right? Like at 5 years, if we're sitting where we were a couple months ago and interest rates are high and there's no buyers, like we're not going to liquidate. We're going to keep, that's the beauty of buying and holding real estate is we're going to hold and we're going to sell when it makes sense. So that would be the other limitation is your people who are looking to invest over time and don't invest money that you're going to need in 3 months because something popped up.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Speaking of trends in the market, what are some trends in the real estate market that you've observed? Obviously I'm interested in your Wyoming area, but also nationwide.
Yeah. Man, this is the coolest one, and I'm probably most excited about is, and I started seeing this probably in October this last year. So again, we've been going direct to sellers. So I'm talking to sellers like all day, every day for the last like 4 years. And I would say up until October, I mean, it didn't happen overnight, but say the last 2 to 3 years, I'm talking to these sellers and we were still finding deals, but not as many because these people were like, well, why do I got to sell to you? I can go list it on the market as is and I'll get a bunch of offers, right? It was stupid. But it obviously shifted with interest rates. And I finally, and especially because I'm always pitching creative finance, like we talked about earlier. So I noticed it really in October, and I've seen this ever since then, is now people are much more, they're listening to my creative finance terms because they don't have there's not as many options. So they're willing to sell on good terms. They're willing to sell at a discount. So I think it's a cool, so there's that piece, right? And part of me was bummed when they decided to drop rates because we were finally seeing good deals and we finally kind of got our bearings and we felt good about it. Then we hear they're dropping rates, but I think it's a really, really unique opportunity where right now it hasn't recovered, right? And in Wyoming specifically, it's a very seasonal market. Like people from like October through like February, it is cold. It is really cold and nobody wants to go out and buy a house. So the market slows down significantly, but when it warms up, it is like, all right, now everybody's back out and everybody's got to go buy their house. So it's all this pent up demand. So you have that pent up demand. You have the pent up demand for all these people that have been sitting on the sidelines because of interest rates. And now if they start to drop in 2024, which you already have as far as like your 30 year mortgages, but now all that pent up demand, I think next summer and into the spring is going to be a great time to sell. So we've actually like doubled, almost like tripled down on our marketing in Q1 because we're like, this is the time to get some deals locked up because it hasn't caught up. Like we're finding good deals now finally, but we see what's coming in the future that like it looks like things could heat up. But even if they don't heat up, we're finding such good deals that we're fine. But I think it's a really cool window right now to be a buyer because if you buy now, you could buy at a discount. And I really believe if they drop rates, all these people, we never solved our supply and demand problem, right? Yeah, exactly. We never solved it, right? And when all these people come back because of interest rates, there's a good chance we're going to be right back where we were. So people who think they need to wait because of interest rates, like I'm going to wait, go buy my house when the rates come down. Well, so is everyone else. And you're going to be competing against them. Go buy the house now and refinance then if you have to.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. No, I agree. I totally agree with you. I think we're into a wild time. If they go and drop those rates anymore, we're going to see housing prices, the likes of which we've never seen.
Yeah.
Which is great for investors. It's horrible for buyers.
Yeah. It's tough. It's a tough market, but it's good to be in the game we're in. So that's why I encourage people that like, yeah, I mean, you've got to own real estate and yeah, like I said, it's undefeated against time. So get in. It's never about like if it's a down market, it's a good time to get in. Even if it's an up market, there's ways to still get in, right? So I encourage people, don't time the market, just get in, and you're gonna learn. You're gonna get your master's in. Like I always say, you don't need to get your MBA. Go to school just in real estate. Literally, just go buy a property. You're gonna go through the school of hard knocks. But if you start to hold real estate and you hold it over time, man, it's always gonna work out. Not always, but usually if you do it right and you're careful and you have liquidity and you don't over leverage and you buy in the right place, you're going to be good over time.
So obviously we talked about, supply in the market, that there's still not enough supply for the demand. The only reason we've really seen tapered buying is because the prices are high and interest rates are high. Any other things that you believe are impacting our real estate market right now? Any other levers?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's definitely some other ones which make it really interesting. But yeah, the biggest ones are, as you said, are supply and demand. Builders are not building fast enough. So one thing I would say is new construction. I mean, if you look at like big money, like Berkshire Hathaway and these people who've got a lot of capital, these private equity funds, they're getting into new construction build to rent because there's not enough builders and they just can't keep up with the supply. I've seen some pretty incredible presentations showing the data on this and it's unbelievable, right? So that's one thing that, again, supply hasn't kept up because essentially we haven't had enough builders. So many builders got knocked out in 2008 and they never came back. They're like, well, forget this. Like they never restarted. So we just caught behind. It's not like people stop having kids, right? Our population continues to grow and we weren't building fast enough. So that's one factor. But the other factor is this, yeah, a recession in the economy, right? And people losing jobs. So it's going to be a really interesting time to where, how does that shake out? Cause I do, yeah, I'm definitely not super bullish on the economy and what's happened and people, things being affordable and now things aren't affordable. So that'll be an interesting variable to see how that shakes in. And maybe that just levels it out to where we don't go bananas in the real estate market again. It's just back to being like pretty hot, low days on market, but it's not like it was when rates were 2 or 3%. So I think that's a component of it. Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting next 12 months.
Yeah. So obviously navigating market fluctuations is important, especially in your, you know, the fix and flip realm, but yeah, even in buy and hold, just sort of being aware of the market is important. You know, what tips or strategies do you recommend for investors who are managing this fluctuation in the market?
Yeah, the biggest one is the easy answer to that is don't do fix and flips, because fix and flips are the biggest risk in that type of a market, right? I think the best way to mitigate it is continue to buy and hold. And really, if you, here's one cool advice, and I'm stealing this from Anson Young. I love Anson. He's a really smart guy, but he's like, underwrite your deals now at 8%. And if you can make a deal work at 8%, like when things drop down, you are going to be sitting pretty. So ultimately tighten up your underwriting, find better deals. And now finally, well, I don't know how much longer this will be, but right now there are motivated people. So find a deal now that pencils and make it work now. And if it works now as a rental, rates, I mean, over time, I think, I don't know, I'm not an analyst, but maybe say 4 to 7% is maybe kind of average of where they should be, right? Eventually we should fall back down there. So still make deals work now. And then when they drop down, your asset will inevitably be worth that much more because there's going to be that much more demand for it. So the biggest thing is buying and holding and still buying and making your deals pencil right now.
That was awesome. I appreciate all of your insight, all of your wisdom. Thank you for joining us today, Casey. We'll have to come back and do this again at some point.
Yeah, I love it, Justin. It's fun, man. As you can see, the passion. I love talking real estate, and it's a fun industry, man. Last thing I'll say is, like you talked about it, like if you're a private money lender, you want to see, like, because we didn't even talk about the cool intrinsic part about fixing a property and how it feels when you fix something up, right?
Sure. Yeah.
There's so many rewards from the industry and doing it. And that's why I love doing it. The fact that I get to do it full time and make a career out of it is pretty fun.
It's awesome. I love it. To our listeners, thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. We'd love to hear your feedback in the comments below. Also, let us know who you'd like to see as a guest on future episodes of Nursing Real Wealth. Join us every other Tuesday for more insightful discussions. Have a great day.